Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Each academic year, Chico State University and Butte College and community members select a book in common to promote discussion and understanding of important issues facing the broader community. The 2017-2018 book in common is A Deadly Wandering by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Matt Richtel. The New York Times Book Review says this book deserves a spot next to Fast Food Nation and To Kill a Mockingbird. Former governor of Utah John Huntsman says Matt Richtel's riveting book is a narrative nonfiction at its finest. In 2010, Matt Richtel won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of articles that exposed the pervasive risks of distracted driving and its root causes, prompting widespread reform. He's a graduate of UC Berkeley and the Columbia Journalism School and is the author of four novels. His book, A Deadly Wandering, interweaves research into attention and information overload with the story of a Utah teenager's tragic 2006 car crash, one of the first texting and driving cases in the United States. Author Matt Richtel will be in Lackson Auditorium on the Chico State campus on October 24th. Matt Richtel, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that introduction.
Well, a story like this, and it is a story, but it's also scientific information that is really riveting, as many of your readers have suggested. So how did you come about, how did you get interested in this story?
Well, the story behind the story actually begins long before the story, and it probably begins with a bit of a personal revelation. I think this is the, I'm going to put the year in the mid-90s, and I am driving in the Bay Area to my newspaper job. And I've got a brick cell phone to my ear. You remember those big old cell phones?
Yeah.
And I am playing a radio game called My Three Songs, where you try to call in as fast as you can to say the connection between the three songs that the station has played so you can win a prize.
Yeah, one of our local stations does this.
It was, in this case, it was KFOG in San Francisco. I bet some of your students and people up there are quite familiar with it. And I'm playing the game, and I'm dialing the phone and driving up the freeway. And at some point in this process, either in this particular day or around here, I think to myself, what is going on? How could I be so drawn to this device that it would be taking me out of my life, even during moments like this where lives are at stake? So let me just put that placeholder there. And if your listeners are wondering what would cause someone to sort of take a skeptical view, this is what happens when you're congenitally a journalist. Instead of saying, wow, look at that new iPhone thing, I go, hey, what's wrong here? So, you know, that's my problem, and there's no medication you can take for it.
Well,
so
I don't think you're unique ahead. In that regard. It's not just your problem. In fact, we all know that texting and driving is dangerous, but we do it anyway.
Right. So that leads us forward. So that's the story behind the story, and that's many years before. That's maybe a decade before this happens. And I'm just watching our collective behavior thinking, this is odd. And then around, you know, 2008, 2009, I start talking to an editor at a paper, and he says, and we say collectively, Nancy, the very thing you just said. Wait a second. We all know this is nuts. What is going on? It was that simple of a question, and that launched a series of stories and a book and everything that followed.
Yeah, because before I read your book, I would ask myself that question. I would get in the car, and that phone would just be a magnet. And for one reason, though, I do use it extensively for my work, and I couldn't do without it. In fact, you can thank technology that you are living in the Bay Area. You live in San Francisco. You don't have to live in New York to write for the New York Times.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a great way of introducing the idea that none of this is a screed against technology any more than, say, saying that junk food is bad for you is a screed against food. Those are not the same thing. You know, who wrote The Jungle?
Tell me, Kipling?
Eons ago, the guy who wrote The Jungle about all the nasty, you know, meat plants wasn't saying don't eat food. He was saying there are side effects here that go along with the industrial process. And so I think what we're talking about here isn't condemning the wonderful things technology brings us, not by any stretch, but it is saying there is more going on here than you may realize. In fact, way, way more.
You know, in fact, as I was reading your book, and it is so, it's such a good read, but there are no bad guys. And I thought, gosh, you've got a mystery, you've got this story that you tell, but there were no, in my view, no bad guys. In spite of what the young teenager's mother thought about the trooper, she didn't think he was such a good guy. But you don't really have any villains in your story.
Well, here this reflects partly my worldview. You know, I tend to think that as you dig beneath people's motivations, many of us are very similar to one another. So there might be somebody on one end of the political spectrum who disagrees vehemently with someone on the other end of the political spectrum, but at their core, their motivations are quite similar. So I think the innovators who came up with this technology, the victims, the law enforcement officials, many of us walk a razor's edge between behaving, you know, kindly towards others, behaving selfishly. And I'll just go a little kind of metaphorical here, but I think the device has given us a great window into the choices we make. I mean, look, I don't think there's anything more selfish, more endemic of the dangers here than someone taking a selfie of themselves while driving.
Oh, gosh.
But in the same breath, Nancy, you see why people are doing it. They are desperate to get attention for themselves. They are swept up in the neurological impulses of getting more information or getting a thrill or a stimulation. It's hard to find bad actors unless you're someone who really likes to point fingers, and that's just not how I'm built.
My guest is Matt Richtel, and he has written a book called A Deadly Wandering, and it's a mystery. He does a lot of investigating, and the science of attention in the digital age, just to have some insight into our attention, because we think, oh, we can multitask. We think that attention is infinite. And that's not what you say in your book.
Yeah, I mean, let's just start with the attention not being infinite. The way we are built is essentially to focus on one thing at a time while being open to the fact that other things may intervene and we will have to attend to them. But the true center of our attention can really only be one thing. And I'll give you a simple kind of a couple of simple bits of science or analogy to underscore that. Would that be okay to give
Sure.
you a couple examples?
Yes.
So Nancy, if you were a cave person and you were tending to a fire, and you got a tap on the shoulder from behind, could you ignore the tap on the shoulder?
No.
And why not?
Because it jumps immediately to the front of your attention.
You don't know if it's opportunity, is it threat, is it someone warning you of lava or a lion, is it a potential mate, someone with food. But that takes you away from the fire. Now, I think it's fairly plain, just thinking about it, but this is, the neuroscientists would tell you that's true. This is true. When your phone rings, it's a little bit like a tap on the shoulder from anyone, anywhere in the world. How hard is that to ignore? I would say just on that basic level, very hard. But you couldn't both attend to the fire and turn around. So let me just leave you that metaphor and tell you a bit of science to sort of underscore this. Going all the way back to World War II, which arguably is the birth of neuroscience and its aftermath, researchers started looking at why the radar operators in Britain or the pilots in the RAF were getting distracted by their digital devices. And so they did this simple test that you or your listeners can do. They would have two people talk to one another, and then they would say, so let's just say, Nancy, you and I are in a conversation. This is called the cocktail party test. And someone starts talking behind you. Do you think you could listen to me while also listening to the person behind you?
No.
No way. The two things you can pick up that we've shown in science are you could maybe pick up the gender of the person behind you or pick up your name because you're so conditioned to hear it. That's how limited our ability to attend to two things at once. So you have these two things working in parallel. One is that you can only attend to one thing at a time, and the other is that you are easily pulled out of a moment of even intense focus by the ping of your device. That's a powerful combination.
Well, you mentioned the cocktail party effect, and I think you came across this notion when you talked to one of the neuroscientists in your book, who's quite a colorful character. I mean, you could make a movie about Dr. Adam Grassley.
Oh, yes.
Both he's a neurologist. He has an MD, a PhD. And so you're...
And you should see his sweet BMW. It is awesome.
Well, it was just such a colorful character, and I think he was the one that introduced you to this idea of the cocktail party effect that you mentioned.
Yes, yes.
Well, I was saying that you went to him with this basic question of what is attention? I mean, we think we know, but then when you start looking into this, you wonder, well, what is attention?
Yeah, what is attention? I mean, when is enough attention enough? How much do you need to pay and under what circumstances? And one of the things that we have learned, there's a bunch to say about this and I'll try not to ramble, but one of the things we've learned is the finite nature of it, or meaning that you can't really adhere to two things at once. But I think what we're also learning in this day and age is that our attention has become a kind of currency that is being sought. We are seeking it from each other, and big, big companies are seeking it from us. And one thing to note here is that for companies like Google or Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat or all these things we use, the collection of our attention is what makes them money. They are creating a sea of attention, and then they are making money by either selling ads against it or subscriptions. Are you with me so far?
Oh, yeah, and I don't know about you, but I have come more and more to resent it. They're so intrusive at getting my attention. Well, that I resent it.
Now let me mess with you a little bit, Nancy.
Okay.
I'm gonna tell you that I think that you and I both are using... are doing similar things by trying to get people's attention right now. There was a guy who came to one of my book readings in Denver, and he said he was really worried about the stuff that you're worried about. And then he said, but I'm a little confused because I am using Facebook to advertise to people. How do I fit into this? And I want to say that before I get to the other half of this equation, I'd like to point out, this is why there are no bad guys exactly, because we are the people using Twitter and Facebook and Google. Let's not leave Google out a little bit because they don't fit quite into the same space here, but they do a little bit as advertisers. But Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, we are the ones that are making this so explosively popular by using it to get one another's attention. So we are not passive actors in this. In fact, one of the reasons these things have grown so much is because they play not only to our desire for stimulation on the consuming side, but they play to our desire to get attention on the other side. So I want to point that out. I want to make one other point about, let me just pause you and say, are you mad at me for pointing that out about us, Nancy? Are we still friends?
Yes. Yes.
do you agree? How do you feel? I'm just curious how you feel about that.
Well, I realize it's true, and that any company that I would work for is going to, is going to have somebody make sure my employer is on Facebook. Everywhere I turn, and usually it's a young person, who makes sure we have a high profile on Facebook.
So there you go. So yeah. We're all party to this thing, and I don't, it's a slightly different conversation when we talk about car companies, say, putting images on the dashboard. That's a little different of a bit of a conversation. But before I get there, and maybe this will lead sort of in that direction, I would point out that while the collection, what Facebook, Google, and others profit from is the collection of this ocean, this creation of an ocean of attention. It's the amassing of all of it. So even though they want our attention, each little individual moment from us may not matter that much. By contrast, each individual moment to us matters a lot. And the simple proof point of that is if you turn away while driving your car for a millisecond from the road, you could kill yourself or somebody else. So that means we're in sort of a value mismatch between the companies and what they want and our own finite amount of attention and how valuable and fragile it is. And that's, go ahead.
No, I was just going to remind listeners that you are Matt Richtel, and we are talking about the book that you've written, A Deadly Wandering, which explores the question of our relationship to technology and what it's doing to our brains. You mentioned that when you're driving, you can't let your attention be distracted. And I often go, there's a canal in France where I navigate a boat. And when I'm steering that boat, I've actually measured how many seconds I can look away. Now, this is a boat. Yep. And I have measured 3 seconds. If I turn my attention, my gaze away for 3 seconds, I have to struggle to get back and steer the boat. And it is so scary to me to think that people are turning their attention, not their eyes or their hands, but their mind away from the driving.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact stat, but I think it's something like in 6 seconds at highway speeds, you travel the length of a football field. Mm. I want to give another little twist on this observation you've made. You know, quite perversely, you might argue that we've made driving just boring enough to be dangerous. Mm-hmm. First of all, let me underscore the word dangerous. Driving is the most dangerous thing most of us will do on any given day, and many of us will do over the course of our lifetimes. Unless you're jumping out of planes, unless you're doing really stupid drugs, unless you're, you know, I don't know, regularly cliff diving, driving is the most dangerous thing you'll do. But I would argue, based on the way people behave behind the wheel, that they are telling themselves a tremendous lie. Now, this goes back to the good guy, bad guy thing. Why are we telling ourselves a lie? You can say, well, we're not attentive enough. We're bad people. We're evil. You know, we're all going to go to HEE hockey sticks, as my daughter would say. But I would prefer to try to dig beneath that and ask, why is it that we behave this way behind the wheel? I think there's a couple of reasons. One, it is boring. We're doing the same thing over and over again, and there's a little bit of a trick we play on ourselves that draws from an interesting kind of human habit. we are terrible scientists in our own lives. So what happens is the algorithm goes like this. Well, or the experiment goes like this. Well, I drove to the store 100 times and 100 times I didn't get in an accident. Therefore, I will never get in an accident. So you have a terrible sample size and it gets amplified or exasperated, exacerbated. Sorry. I've said the word 100, exasperated 100 times and never made a mistake. And there it is. You text and drive 25 times and don't get in a wreck. And you essentially condition yourself to believe that you won't get in a wreck. So that the 26th time is when you get very badly hurt because you believed that prior behavior was predictive. You just don't have a sufficient sample size to make that result. And moreover, what you can't even control all the variables in that equation. There was a when I first started this, before I even got to Reggie, I went to Utah coincidentally to meet one of the leading scholars in the field, a guy named David Strayer. And David actually helped turn me on to Reggie. And he was a leader in the field and remains a leader in the field. And I was looking through a stack of court cases that he'd been asked to testify in. And there was one that really stuck with me because it involved a driver who didn't really do anything wrong and killed someone. Can I tell it to you briefly?
Yes.
So, guy is driving across the Bay Bridge. I'm sorry, the Golden Gate Bridge. He's going north. It's after work. And he calls his wife on the phone, puts it to his ear. Well, didn't have hands free. He's driving just fine. And they start talking about what to order from the Indian food restaurant for dinner. And a gust of wind comes up and a car from coming the other direction briefly swerves into his lane. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's been some years now, but I believe there's a woman in the car coming at him who dies. Now, you could say to yourself, well, bully for her. She, too bad for her. She swerved. But what the neuroscience would say is, if he hadn't been on the phone, even though it wasn't him swerving into her lane, he would have had the reaction time to move out of the way. So I just want to point out the variables aren't always ones that you can control in the millisecond that puts someone at risk.
My guest is Matt Richtel, and he has written a book, A Deadly Wandering, and one of the subtitles, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. We've been talking about the science behind attention and compulsion and addiction and why we do this, and that we knowing that texting and driving is dangerous, and we do it anyway. But you tell a story interwoven in the science behind it, the legal ramifications. You tell this young teenager, teenagers are young, this young man who is involved in an accident, and this is in Utah, and you mentioned that one of your neuroscientists is in Utah, so that was convenient that Dr. David Strayer was already in Utah. We collaborated with Dr. Gazzoli in San Francisco.
Yep.
To answer that question, how does technology impact the ability of drivers to focus behind the wheel? And that's one of the you have a lot of questions that you're seeking answers to. And in the process of seeking those answers, you meet a lot of very interesting characters. And I was impressed by the fact that you went into the background of all these characters in your story. For example, when Reggie, this young teenager who causes the accident, when he goes to his counselor, you describe the counselor's office. So Matt, you must have gone to the Reggie's counselor's office to describe the books on her shelf, did you do that? Did you?
The short answer is yes. And I just want to say I'm glad you liked the backstories. Some people didn't want to hear about everybody. I'm glad you enjoyed them, but I'll tell you why I did that. And how I did that. I think that if you're going to ask readers to think very seriously about a topic that touches all of us, you have to make things as real as possible to communicate to them that this is serious, that you are not pontificating of your own, in a sort of in a narcissistic way about your own beliefs. You owe them veritas. So I went to find out who these people were and to listen and to try to communicate about them on their own terms. Maybe that's just a personal preference about how to tell a story, but I tried to exhibit that. I would just add one more thing, kind of laying myself bare. We began this conversation by saying we're all sort of guilty of trying to get one another's attention. I personally just like to read things where story is at the center, not I don't like reading white papers. I like reading narrative and story. And so I just thought the best way to get my readers' attention was to tell them a yarn above all else. And that led me into the lives of these characters.
Yeah, and there are a lot of them that you went into their backgrounds, and then we understood their motivation. When they come into the story, Reggie's story is the background story, and when all these other people walk onto the stage in his story, we know what their motivations are and what they are like and why they would be so passionate about what they do. I do want to ask you more questions about, for example, bottom-up attention versus top-down attention.
Yep.
And one of your neuroscientists explained that to you. This was a woman, Anne Treisman. And how did she explain this bottom-up attention and top-down attention?
Oh, you're going to have to help me because I wrote this book a long time ago. Give me a hint. I mean, I know what bottom up and top down is, but I can't remember how she described it.
Well, you kind of touched on it earlier when you said our intention, we pick out something we want to pay attention to. And this is the top down. We decide, okay, I'm going to pay attention to the road. I'm going to drive. And yet we hear a ding, a sound on our phone. And there's that bottom up attention that grabs us.
So this is this essentially correlates with two different parts of our brain. The top-down attention comes from what's known as our prefrontal cortex, our frontal lobe. I mean, it's well named. You can put your hand on your forehead, and this is the most evolved part of the human being. It's responsible for art and architecture, and all of our great feats. You need to be able to organize, dictate, and focus on thoughts in a, let's call it a less reactive way. But it can be easily overtaken by bottom-up attention, which comes now if you just pat the back of your neck. This is sort of your brainstem. It's a much more reptilian part of us, and is we share in common with, much less evolved animals. There's a reason why, we talked about it earlier, there's a reason why bottom-up can overtake top-down. It's because in a crisis or an acute moment, what really has to kick in is your survival skills, whereas the frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex, is something we have the luxury of using when we have a little bit more time. Both are critical, but in a way they're competing.
We're going to take a break now, and I do want to give you a chance to introduce Reggie Shaw, this young man who we follow throughout the book. And you think, that story of Reggie's over now. And then there was more and more to his story that I found fascinating. It was a real page-turner. We are going to take a break. My guest is Matt Richtel, and his book is this year's Book in Common, A Deadly Wandering. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Each year, Chico State and Butte College select a book in common to promote discussion and understanding of issues that face our broader community. And this year's book in common is A Deadly Wandering, and the author is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Matt Richtel. He is a reporter for the New York Times. And Matt, I think you're also a cartoonist.
Well, I used to. It's even worse than that, Nancy. For about a decade, I did a cartoon. I was a writer and the writer of it, and it's still being syndicated, but somebody's taken it over, the illustrator. It was called Rudy Park. But let me tell you how bad it's gotten. Now, recently, I did a children's book called The Runaway Booger and wrote a song to go with it. Called Don't Pick Your Nose, that actually got a little bit of radio play, and I performed it, and it's not good. So when you got a muse like this, you just go with it. What choice do I have?
Well, fortunately, I don't think that's what you'll be talking about when you come to Chico.
Wait, give me a chance.
But I do want to let people know, or remind them, that you will be coming here October 24th and discussing your book, this book in common. That is so fascinating. And I really found it personal. I know you're telling the story of this young man, but so much of it, I thought, gosh, I've wondered that myself. So we've talked a bit, and we're not finished with the technology, but I do want to let you tell us who Reggie Shaw is.
Oh, man, Reggie's such a decent human being, such an incredible story of, as the subtitle says, tragedy and redemption. So picture he's 19 years old. He grows up in, he's Mormon and devout. All he wants to do is go on a mission. And for reasons I don't want to give away, but become ultimately, well, I'll let you decide, Nancy, but that make him that much more complicated of a character. He is actually essentially kicked out of his first mission. And it's during a period after he's been kicked out of his mission and trying to earn his way back that he is driving on a road at 6:30 in the morning, going to a painting job. It's dark. It's beginning to kind of rain, even freezing rain. And just before I tell you what happened next, I want to let you know that not only is he a devout young man, he's a nice young man. He's the sixth man on the basketball team. You know, the guy who comes in and works extra hard to hustle. His teachers like him, the girls like him, but no one in kind of an obnoxious way. He's just a good, popular, decent guy. And he's driving on the road this morning, and there's a pickup truck behind him. Shall I describe what happens next or not?
Yeah, well, tell us when and where.
This is September 22, 2006, if memory serves. And it's 6:30 in the morning on a kind of windy road in northern Utah, surrounded by mountains and descending into a gorgeous valley. But as I say, it's dark. And coming the other direction that morning are two gentlemen in a Saturn, Jim Fafaro and Keith O'Dell. They are family men. They are scientists. In fact, believe it or not, I know it's often a cliche, but they are genuinely rocket scientists. They're working on the booster for the next space shuttle at a big industrial military plant in the valley there.
In fact, Matt, as I'm reading your story, I thought, gosh, if this were fiction, people say, oh, this is just too... I can't believe this. There's so many aspects to the story. You think, oh my gosh, how could that possibly have been true? And you say one of the Keith O'Dell, his nickname was the genius.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just drives a knife in your heart the more you read about this. But anyway.
Yeah. And just to bring, you know, this is the kind of like little details that unfolded, but you know, one of them was munching Cheerios from a bag and the other one was eating a red Fuji apple, and they're going to work and they've said goodbye to their wives and their families. And as Reggie is descending down this big hill, he begins to swerve occasionally across the yellow divider. And there's a pickup truck behind him driven by a guy who is toting in a trailer 2 tons of horseshoes and horseshoe making equipment. So you got the picture here. Here's Reggie in an SUV, a guy behind him also going around 60 miles an hour that has horseshoes and horseshoe making equipment. And then coming the other way is the Saturn. Is that picture pretty clear to you?
Yeah. And this is how we have a witness, this farrier behind Reggie, John Kaiserman. And the fact that he is there, that means we know what was happening a few seconds before the crash.
Oh, it was so painful to talk to John. He says to me that he sees Reggie occasionally swerving across the yellow divider. And then he says to me that he said to himself, this quote has just stuck with me. He says, I thought to myself, this guy's going to cause us all some trouble. So Reggie, the next time Reggie swerves across the yellow divider, he clips the Saturn with Jim and Keith. And now the roads are wet and they're going 60 miles an hour. And Jim and Keith start spinning. Now, it's my guess, I think this is what the testimony showed, that they probably didn't see the truck and trailer coming behind Reggie because it was dark and it was behind them. And John Kaiserman, who was driving the truck and trailer, could not swerve out of the way as the Saturn spun into his path. And he utterly decimated the car. I hesitate to use the word he. He couldn't have helped himself. The truck collided into the Saturn, and both scientists were dead on impact. And that's how our book starts, Nancy. It starts with a mystery because Reggie tells the state trooper who shows up, I must have hydroplaned. Or maybe it was them who swerved into my lane.
Because I wasn't on my phone. That's Reggie's, what he first said.
He said it. I don't know. Maybe he even believed it. Maybe he was so lost in his foolishness that he didn't remember. It's easy to ignore or not even recognize something you've done a bunch of times.
Yeah, I think
it was just habit.
I think as the reader is, you do go back and forth and say, well, no, he's lying. But then on the other hand, you can think of times in your own life when something happens so suddenly and you don't know. Was I on my phone? Was I not? And I don't think I was. So as a reader, it is a mystery and we don't know from one page to the next what's going to happen.
Yeah, I like that you made that point, Nancy, insofar as, you know, it's like part of this story is just about what's happening inside our minds in the modern age. And our realities, to some extent, are shaped by what we're paying attention to. So there's a way in which Reggie could be understandably uncertain of what was happening. His reality was almost split. Was he paying attention to his phone? Was he paying attention to what was happening outside? It's a very interesting kind of thought experiment about whether your actual reality depends on what you're attending to.
And then we have this trooper who some people accuse him of being too thorough because the whole thing might have just been dropped.
Yeah, it probably would have been dropped. It's 2006. There's no laws on the books.
Yeah, so this young man, this teenager, was not breaking the law because there was no law.
Yeah, and Trooper Rindelsbacher is one tough SOB. And he doesn't, and maybe to a fault, depending on who you listen to. And he says he takes Reggie to the hospital. And along the way, he notices that Reggie, he has to take him for a required blood test. That's why Reggie's going to the hospital in a trooper's car.
You want to make sure there's no alcohol.
Sorry, go ahead. There's no alcohol. But there's no sign of foul play. Accidents happen all the time, right? Cell phones aren't a part of the vernacular or texting for the most part. I don't think Root Rindelsbacher, in fact, I'm sure, but he had no idea how to text. He had to go look it up. It was only the kids texting in 2006. I mean, I'm being facetious, but, you know. And I should, wait, I got to pause here, Nancy. This is not a problem that has to do with young people. This is correct. Affects yes. everybody. So I yes. just...
The fact that he was a teenager, yeah, it could be any of us. Yeah.
It could be. But in any case, Rindelsbacher, the trooper, sees Reggie's... He senses that Reggie's phone buzzes, and he sees Reggie pull out his phone and texts with one hand. And he says to me, and this is another chilling statement, that when he said this to me, I just went, whew. He said, that's when I knew he was a one-hander. Mm-hmm. So Rindelsbacher saying to himself, hey, listen, I'm a cop. You know, the cops are like, they'd probably hate this comparison, but in the same way I describe myself as congenitally journalistic, they're congenitally cops. And they're saying, okay, is that just something that happened or a piece of evidence? I think I credit him with incredible instincts.
And they were alerted when he sees this kid can manipulate his phone with one hand. Therefore, he could have one hand on the steering wheel and the other hand he could be texting.
Yep.
And also, he is the one that subpoenaed the phone records. And I think...
Yeah, so he's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think that was... He may have been ahead of his time in coming up with that idea.
Oh, by all means. Listen, you mentioned earlier, and I was glad you said it this way, but... You said this was one of the first criminal texting and driving trials. I often say it was among the first myself because you learn as a New York Times reporter, people have their views of the New York Times these days, but I'm a pretty big flag waver for the institution, and we never say more than we can prove.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It is my belief that it is almost certainly the first criminal and driving texting case in the country. The reason I've hesitated saying that is because you never know if there's something that showed up in some state on the book somewhere that I couldn't find. So I never wanted to make that statement. But there, to your point, there's a good chance this is, if not the first, one of the first handful. There's no real precedent for this. So here he is saying, Rindelsbacher saying, let's go after this guy. I want the phone records. And even the prosecutor's office is going, give me a break, man. He lost his attention.
Well, and as the reader, too, we think, oh, okay, he's got the phone records. He's going to find something else. But no, the first evidence he gets, they're just the phone calls. And so you think, well, he went down a blind alley there.
Can you imagine you're writing this book and like the thing is unfolding like a screenplay you couldn't have ever imagined writing, like, you get one step forward, then you get a roadblock, then there's another revelation. Like, I mean, it just, I remember being in the room, you know, my wife works part-time, and the day she was home, I would come downstairs and say, you're not going to believe this. it was just the phone records. Oh, no, now they found the texting records. You know, I don't know. It was one of those stories.
So we have this young man, Reggie Shaw, who really wants to go on a mission, and he's pulled off that first attempt, so he wants to keep his nose clean and be eligible to go on another mission. And so we wonder, well, is he going to get to do this? And it looks like he's going to make a clean getaway. Was that the case?
Yep. Well, obviously not. I mean, it doesn't owe just to Rindelsbacher, but there is in this story... another character who's almost too remarkable to believe. Her name's Terrell Warner, and she decides that she's a prosecutor's basically assistant, a victim's advocate, and she grew up under very difficult circumstances that caused her, like Rindelsbacher, depending on how you look at it, she's either exactly the kind of toughness that we need in this world, or has a huge chip on her shoulder, or maybe both.
Yeah,
and I say
tough.
That with great affection for all of these characters, but especially Terrell. I mean, she and Reggie are now very, you know, I consider them in a certain way like family. But she said to the prosecutors, we cannot let this stand. I don't care I don't care how nice you think this kid is. I don't care, frankly, she didn't say this aloud, but it was going through her mind. I don't care, because she's very devout Mormon herself. I don't care if she's the kind of kid that we revere in our society here, a good Mormon kid who just wants to go on a mission. Two people are dead. I will not stand by. And then she goes and takes some steps that are, I guess for want of a really blunt word, courageous.
Yeah. Yeah. And the widows of these two scientists, their stories are heartbreaking because one of them seems to be able to go on with their life and one is just devastated. Keith Odell's wife, they were just so perfect for each other. And then she's just bereft.
Yeah.
And so we have such sympathy for these widows that lost their husbands, destroyed their families.
I thought a lot about how much to show their grief. And in the end, you could make the case that it's the most important thing in the book, because if you can't connect to their grief, then you can't connect to the stakes of attending to things or making choices. And it's in this case, it's in the car, but it's in lots of places where our failure to attend has consequences, and they embody what those consequences are. Can you imagine a knock on the door? Can you imagine being the mom that has to tell the daughter? I mean, when Jim's wife told me about telling, I almost can't even talk about it now without choking up, telling the youngest that daddy wasn't ever coming home again, sitting on the couch, or telling the oldest in the car when she picked her up from school and her daughter not even being able to process it, and asking something like so childlike afterwards, like, well, does that mean we're not going to the gymnastics meet this weekend? Because she couldn't process it. Those are the human moments that make this live.
In fact, that's really what took you to Dr. Gasly. Your question was, why are two rocket scientists dead?
Yes.
Why did this happen?
Yep. So I decided to start with what a few of us inside the New York Times call the good dumb question. Rather than surmise anything or take anything for granted, I just said, okay, this doesn't make any sense to me. Reggie's good. The scientists are good. These are nice people. They're not jerks. No one took a gun and held up a place because, I don't remember the Executioner's song.
Yeah.
This is not like Gary Gilmore whimsically deciding to murder people at a gas station. So I started off by simply saying, what is it about our brains that has allowed this to happen? What I've tried to do in the story was pair the crime and punishment piece of this, the intimate portrayal of Reggie, the police hunt for his guilt, the prosecutors wrestling with the law, his ultimate redemption, with an effort to answer the question, how did we wind up here in the first place and what can we do about it?
My guest is Matt Richtel, and his book is A Deadly Wandering, a Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. And I wonder if it's the age of attention or the age of inattention that's causing the problem. So the tragedy was this young man, because of his texting to rocket scientists are dead. And he realizes what the truth of the matter was, as best it could be determined. And how did he feel when he realized that he had been the cause of this, the death of these two scientists?
Well, you're going to choke me up again, but readers will make their own determination of how they feel about Reggie, and I've heard lots of different viewpoints about him. But for my money, and with all due respect to the amazing families of the men who were killed, and great sorrow for them, I will tell you that I believe Reggie to be an amazing human being. And the reason goes to the answer to your question. when he realized, or rather when he owned up to what had been happening, he dedicated him. Well, first he was devastated because he'd held the lie or the misunderstanding or whatever. You'll have to read it and decide yourself what it was that he was, what caused him to not own it. But once he did, all those feelings came flooding out. Basically 2 years of denial. How about let's use denial?
Yeah.
And he came undone. And then he did something I've never seen anybody do, and I doubt I'll ever see anybody do, which is dedicate himself to redeeming himself and then actually go do it. And that's the thing. That's the thing that makes Reggie so remarkable. People say, people do bad things. I haven't done things like that. I don't even want to say bad. Yes, I've not done bad things like that, but I've done my share of things I need to be contrite for. I've made my share of mistakes in this lifetime. And I know people who have made big mistakes. And I've not known a single person to have dedicated their lives to fixing it. And he does. He gets up in front of audiences and he sobs and he says, do not do what I have done. I am begging you. And it's particularly interesting in his case because, remember I mentioned he played basketball and was popular and did well with the girls. When you see him come apart on stage, you're not watching a guy who you think might come apart. You're watching a guy who looks like a bit of a tough guy, a bit like, you know, a dude from high school. And he lays himself bare. It is so powerful. I think he's – one of the mission presidents, a guy fairly high up in the church I got to know, said to me, my God, he's – more than lived his mission.
Yeah.
This is his mission. It's chilling stuff.
In fact, somebody told him that was his mission. His mission was saving lives.
Yeah, and I do believe he's done so. Reggie has made a believer out of me that you can make a difference in this world. And I think it takes tremendous courage, even more so than anybody in the book. It's taken tremendous courage because every time he talks about it, he has to remember that he killed two family men, two husbands, two decent people, two people who didn't deserve to die, not that day, not that way.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Matt Richtel. His book is A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. And I mentioned that you will be here in Chico, October the 24th, and I'm hoping that, because Reggie reached a lot of people when he would give his talks and tell what happened to him and talking in person, and I'm hoping that people will listen to you that, well, I'll give you an example. When I took your book with me on a long road trip, and I was scared reading your book to think, oh my gosh, I hope the other drivers on this long trip are not texting and paying attention to their phone. And when I got to Idaho, I'd taken your book with me and mentioned the book that I was reading. And the friends that we went to visit, one had been a nurse, he'd retired. And when I read the page in your book about what doctors are doing, before I even told him, I hadn't even read that page, because this comes toward the end, the very end of your book, The Electronic Distraction Among Doctors, Nurses, and Medical Technicians. And this nurse said he sees people, you know, walking down the hall, they're supposedly doing their job, and they're on their phone. And so he had observed that. And then I get to your book and realized that a neurosurgeon, well, tell what happened to the neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I got a call from a medical school professor saying, you're not going to believe what's happening in the hospitals. I go, okay, tell me. He said, well, people are doctors, surgeons, anesthesiologists, others are using their phones while they're supposed to be attending patients I go, attending patients, he goes, let me tell you a crazy story. And it turned out to be true that I believe it was in Denver where a surgeon was watching 40-year-old virgin on his phone when, and I'm going to choose my words carefully because I don't remember exactly how I put them there, but when he allegedly made a mistake that paralyzed someone.
You said a neurosurgeon was making personal calls during the surgery, and the patient ended up being partially paralyzed.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry, the 40-year-old virgin was another story. I believe both are so.
Well, and like I say, I had independently this nurse tell me this before I even got to this far into your book, because I said this was fairly near the end of your book. And even the landscape I was driving through looks like the illustration depicted on your cover of your book. With mountains
in
this
highway. We started out talking about whether these people are good or bad. You know, it's not like you'd say doctors are bad, but something about these devices is causing us to make decisions or to fail to make decisions that are putting us on the bad side of the ledger.
And you make us wonder about the question: what is technology doing to our brains? Is it creating a compulsion? Is it more of a compulsion than addiction, or maybe just habit forming? But I do want to let readers read your book for themselves. And you'll be signing books, I believe, when you come to Lexan Auditorium. That's October 24th. Your book is scary, but I think it's so important, Matt. Thank you for doing this research and writing this story for us.
Well, I'm honored you'd have me on, and I do promise I'll get at that very question you raise about compulsion and addiction and where we are there and why and what the science is. And I would please come on out and say hello to everybody who's listening. We'd love to keep this conversation going.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Nancy.
My guest has been Matt Richtel. His book is A Deadly Wandering. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.